It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Miriam Berry was going to be my guest this half hour. She's a Republican candidate for Congress. I'm trying to go through the list of statewide candidates and get each one a turn on the Dave Graham Show on WDEB, FM, and AM here. And I apologize for asking her to wait a day or two to get on the radio with us. But there's so many loose ends left in that conversation that we just were having with Kathy Resmer of 7 Days. I asked Kathy to stay with us, and she's very kindly agreed to do so. But we also have a caller on the line right now. Fred from Newbury is with us. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, another great show. Hey, my question is, I was watching Keith Matthews, and when I turned it on, Kondraty was on, and he was saying that, we're going to miss Chris Matthews. He was a great guy. And I said, my God, Chris must have died. But he didn't. He just walked off the show. Why did he walk off the show?
I missed some of that because there was noise in the background or something. Fred, are you talking about Chris Matthews, formerly with MSNBC?
The story was like this. Chris Matthews, I turned his program on, and Chris Matthews wasn't on. Kondraty was on. You still got noise in the background.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Not sure what that is.
Okay, so anyways, Chris Matthews wasn't on, and Kondraty was on, and he was saying, Chris Matthews was a nice guy. We'll miss him. And I thought Chris Matthews had died, but he didn't. He just walked off the program. Why did he walk off the program?
I'm trying to remember this. He made some controversial comments that brought a lot of heat on MSNBC. I don't remember what they were. I'm sure I could look them up in a minute if I went to Google. But I'm gonna put that off for now and just mention that was he made these controversial comments. I don't know exactly what the terms of his departure from his program on MSNBC were, but it was rather abrupt. And I don't know. Do you recall, Kathy, what the deal was with Chris Matthews?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
Okay, totally. That's all right.
No idea. I mean,
you can't follow everything, that's for sure. I'd say we're both striking out on this. That's okay. I don't know exactly what happened, but I remember he made some very controversial remarks on his program, stuff that some people really did criticize him and MSNBC for. I don't remember exactly the nature of those remarks. He then left, just days later.
He left that night?
Did he leave that night, was it? Okay. Well, I'm not sure about that. But
I was watching it, and so Kondraty comes on. And Kondraty says, Chris was a great guy. We'll miss him, the whole nine yards. And Kondraty was breathing hard and everything. And I thought, Chris had died.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's, as far as I know, he's still among, he's still living and breathing, as far as I know. And don't know exactly where he is right now. He was getting to be retirement age. Fred, I got to go. Thank you for the call. And sorry we can't shed any much further light on that whole situation. But Kathy, among the loose ends we left in the earlier segment, our caller Jeff was asking about media bias and how it used to be we'd get both sides of the story and so on. One thing I wanted to mention was that and you responded well by just saying that at 7 Days you always call the person who is the target of criticism to get their take on events and so on. And this still happens every day with the New York Times and the Washington Post and other mainstream media where, I routinely read Times and Post stories where, they have their sources telling them X, Y, and Z is happening. And then they call the White House to get the official comment. And that to me is a very old standard in journalism. You always touch that base. You kind of go to the official spokesperson or to the person, him or herself, and say, here's what they're saying about you, so you tell us what gives, right? I mean, that's pretty standard, right?
Yep.
But I hear this complaint a lot, that there's a sense from many critics of the mainstream media that somehow that has fallen by the wayside. And I certainly think that while it may have for some bloggers and some people who are who are just out there really more in the opinion business than in the news business, there is still that tradition of trying to get the other side of the story. I will say that the media have become more aggressive about, and I should preface this actually by saying that we live in very unusual times with this president. I mean, he's a lot of his conduct is just so, frankly, first time ever kind of stuff that it leaves people trying to find their way through new territory, essentially. And I'm not saying the performance has been entirely perfect either. But, you know, just for one example, last year when the president said that the four young women of color in the Congress should all, quote unquote, go back where they came from, a number of the media outlets around the country described that as, you know, racist comments by the president, just as sort of a matter of fact. And, you know, I remember when I was first coming out of journalism or in journalism school, I had a professor who said one of the important things you got to remember is the principle of show, don't tell. So in other words, right. you actually quote the people doing and saying things, and then you let the reader decide whether you don't just say it was a beautiful day. You say the sky was blue and the sun was shining, and then let the reader conclude it was a beautiful day.
Right.
to put it very, very simply, you know. And so in this case, I saw a violation of that old standard. In which the media are now saying, "Hey, we're not going to put the evidence in front of you, reader, to allow you to conclude that the president is being racist. We're going to go ahead and say he's being racist." And I don't know. What do you think? Is that something that's okay, or is that something that is bad form?
Well, you know, I think it's very tricky. Everyone's having a lot of conversations about this right now. And how do we present both sides, or how can we present criticism without, I don't know, I guess I'm saying we really have to be careful not to turn some readers off or to describe things in a way that is an easy shorthand that's going to, that's not going to be a great... Sorry, I'm a little distracted.
That's okay.
I think it's really tricky. You know, it's really, really tricky. And especially when you go to the official source, what they're saying is not based in fact and cannot be confirmed. And you have so many questions. I've just been, you know, just following this story over the last few days of, well, was President Trump briefed on the this intelligence that says that Russian there was a bounty on American soldiers instigated by Russia, paid by Russia. Just following that conversation and having some people say, well, maybe he wasn't briefed orally, but he was in his presidential daily briefing. And then you have people saying that's always constituted a brief before. And then you have other people saying, well, but he wasn't briefed. You know, just getting down to what does the word brief mean? In this situation, it's so difficult when we've relied on official sources to follow certain rules and standards and norms, and in many cases now they're not. And so, how do we report in that situation? That very changed and different information landscape. It's very, very tricky.
Yeah, it really is, and you know, where sometimes statements get made that then are contradicted the very next day by sources coming out and saying, in this case, no, in fact, he did get a presidential daily briefing on this. I was on the radio yesterday and somebody actually sent me an email kind of yelling at me about this as being too kind to Trump. But I used the analogy of okay, so you were in class and the teacher did cover this material. But you just weren't listening because you were daydreaming or looking out the window or passing notes to your friends or whatever else, right? You know, I mean, there's a level of diligence here, which may be what's missing. And basically, you know, I can imagine somebody who's a Trump defender getting on my case for saying he's not a particularly diligent student of much of anything. Except, well, we could make a list, I guess. But but this person, I guess, was a Trump critic who said, "I'm cutting him. You know, I'm giving him a pass." And no, if you don't listen in class, you don't get a pass, okay? I just want to make that clear. Anyway.
I want to make clear, too, that I am not the person at 7 Days who deals with what you're describing and how do we use what kind of language we're using. I'm not in the trenches on those. I'm present for some of those discussions, but I'm definitely not the definitive source for that.
That's on the editorial side. You're more the business side, right?
Yes. If we could, I do wanted to get back to some of the stuff about the Facebook boycott, if we could.
Absolutely. Yeah. We are getting a bit astray here. So
I did try to prepare a little bit for this and was just thinking about specifically if I could share a couple things. So one of the things that's underpinning this boycott is that it's very difficult to stop rumors that are started on Facebook and in Facebook groups and things. You know, when you think about something like Front Porch Forum, which is our Vermont-based community forums, you know, there is actually a human being that's reading the posts in those forums, and I'm sure that they are hitting misinformation there too, but they're stopping some of it. There's a little more, I think, a tighter control on it. But if you're looking at a group on Facebook, I'm sure you can be part of a closed group. It could have hundreds of thousands of people in it. There's no moderator from Facebook who's saying, hey, you can't say this, or you shouldn't say this, or hey, this doesn't check out. You know, people are just sharing this information. And one of the things that is very recent that came up just in the last few weeks about Facebook groups is that, you know, the New York Times just reported a couple weeks ago that in 41 towns, they found in 41 towns, there were rumors about Antifa coming to a town, and that were false, totally false, but that were spread and amplified by social media, and that actually caused real-world problems. So there was this one example that I pulled out in Locust, North Carolina. I just wanted to share. So in late May, there was this rumor. Somebody in town, maybe on Twitter or in some forum, said, I heard that 2 busloads of Antifa are coming to Locust, North Carolina, near Charlotte. And on June 1st, that started getting shared in text. People around town are sharing with each other. And then it surfaces in a Facebook group, a couple of Facebook groups, one called Deplorable Pride and one called Albemarle News and Weather, right? These 2 Facebook groups that exist. And suddenly this rumor about busloads of Antifa are spreading. And nobody's debunking it. And you can't see it. If you're outside of these groups, you can't see this happening. It's just these closed networks of people who are sharing this rumor. And then on June 1st, the police in Locust post a screenshot of a text. And they say, on their Facebook, they say, this is a text that falsely claims that police were knocking on doors to warn that, quote, a black organization was bringing 2 busloads of people to Walmart in Locust with intentions on looting and burning down the suburbs, end quote. The police find this text, they share it on Facebook, they say, this rumor is spreading, this rumor is false. This is not happening. It's a racist rumor. It's a, you know, there's this very real and important demonstrations against police brutality, peaceful demonstrations against police brutality happening all over the country. And in 41 towns, the New York Times reported that there were instances like this. And in Locust, North Carolina, the police tried to fight back against this rumor that is false on Facebook. And so they actually, even though it was false, even though the police had no record that there was any truth to this busloads of Antifa coming to disrupt this demonstration that was happening, they put extra resources out on the street. They beefed up they beefed up their police presence to fight this thing that's a rumor. And the New York Times pointed out at the end of the article that they tracked it down. The original rumor on Facebook where this happened was seen by 27,855 people.
Wow.
The police posts about how it was false were seen by 2,966 people. So on Facebook, you've got this amplification of lies and misinformation. It's impossible to catch up with. That expression, the lies and everything are they're out the door and running down the street before truth even has is laced up its boots, you know?
Yeah, yep.
That these lies are spreading in these ways. And the system that Facebook uses now to moderate or to screen for stuff like this in their groups, it's just inadequate. And it's having a serious effect on our society. And like I said, this is just one example in Locust, North Carolina, that I was referring to. But there are similar examples all over the country where these kinds of rumors about busloads of Antifa get spread. And we're not seeing them in a big forum where everyone can say, oh, I saw that. That's crazy. You know,
yeah. It's
spreading
yeah.
among people who are spreading it because they believe it, because they're already, it's a confirmation bias situation.
I mean, that's a huge problem. And actually, I mean, there are cases where that very rumor was kind of bleeding from just Facebook posts into other media, especially in this case, because it was, you know, trying to point to Antifa as a boogeyman or a boogeywoman or something.
A boogie person.
Okay, I'm sorry. coming from some of the more conservative media outlets, shall we say? In fact, to make it more local, we had something right here in our own midst where one of Vermont's conservative media outlets a few weeks ago had a headline. I don't have it in front of me right now, but it was something to the effect of Massachusetts State Police watching for Antifa on towns along Vermont's border. So in other words, this raises a specter that Antifa is on Vermont's southern border, ready to, I don't know, move in or something. And yep. And the one case that was cited was that the mayor of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, had issued a memo talking about how there might be stepped up state police presence, Massachusetts state police presence in Pittsfield, in the coming week, because there were rumors that Antifa might show up in Pittsfield. This got picked up by a NPR station in the region, which put it out there. And then this Vermont media outlet ran a story with a headline about Antifa on Vermont's southern border. You know, I had to send in a note mentioning the fact that Pittsfield is actually 27 miles from Vermont's southern border. So a little factual problem there in the headline. And I think this was about a week after it happened, and it talked about, you know, a fairly imminent thing, like supposed to be happening in the next week. And I said, so what has happened in the past week? And I sort of joked that a more accurate headline might have said that on something like on Vermont mass border, all quiet since Shays' Rebellion, which, of course, was in the 18th century. But anyway, you know, that kind of stuff is, and I think actually it's helpful if people who see this kind of bunk on Facebook or anywhere in the media try to sort of debunk it and well, it's not quite that way, and we don't really need to worry about busloads of Antifa showing up in our town, and let's all try to take a chill pill and be reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, I think the most important thing that people can do right now is to practice what the News Literacy Project calls information hygiene. Mm-hmm. You know? So if you see something, a piece of information somewhere, before you share it, look into it. Does it look credible? Is it, where did it come from? Who spread it? Why? What benefits when you spread it? And then don't hit share until you're sure that it's true. So I see this so often, I'm sure you do too, on Facebook, especially with some of my less digitally savvy friends or relatives, people who might be sharing things. And, you know, you've got a meme and it says something like, message from police, look out for this thing happening. And if you look at it, you can say, like, okay, the Burlington Police Department, their official Facebook page has their phone number, has their address, has a little blue check. It's a verified account. Like, I know when Burlington Police Department is sending me a message on Facebook, I know what it is. This meme, who made this meme? Where did it come from? Why should I trust this message from police? You know, but I think people just see something and they have a reaction to it and they just hit that share button. It's just like many people have called it an infodemic. Like, we're in the pandemic. This is an infodemic. Like, people are spreading this stuff virally.
And the only
way to stop it is to vaccinate yourself by not spreading it in the first place.
Right, right. And I confess, I'll say stuff on Facebook that I won't say on the radio because it's oftentimes meant to be quite, you know, tongue in cheek, or it's a bad pun or something, or just, you know, I'm goofing off in my spare time or whatever. I fear sometimes maybe somebody will expect me to be exactly the same personality on Facebook that I am on the radio. And I say, well, to me, it's more like if you were a musician and you played in a symphony orchestra, but you play in a jazz band in your spare time. It depends on the context. You're not going to show up for the symphony gig and start playing jazz licks. So, I'm going to be, I want to mention the callers checking in with us. I am going to be opening the phone lines for a little bit after the 10:05 interview with one of our CBS News correspondents, and between say 10:15 and 10:30 may be a better time, because I wanted to get back to with you, Kathy Resmer, in these last few minutes of our time together here this morning. The whole question of, we've talked a lot about kind of the quality of what's being delivered by this huge new medium, Facebook, and we haven't even gotten to Twitter yet, but there's another story. But I guess what's to kind of tie this package up and put a bow on it, what is the what's concerning to me anyway is when you talk about ad revenue leaving local media, like 7 Days, like VT Digger, in the form of their underwriters and stuff. They have a different style, being a nonprofit, but same idea. You know, money going to local media, money going to WDEV, or that used to go to WDEV, and now people are shifting over to Facebook. There's been a big local vore movement in Vermont in recent years when it comes to food and it comes to just other products and so on and so forth. I'm surprised I don't hear more about urging Vermont businesses that are in the market to buy advertising to try that local vore thing. I mean, is that something that the Vermont media ought to join together and make a campaign out of or something?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are. I know that 7 Days, we're talking about that with every single pitch. It's like when you're buying local is really important. We're doing that, of course, for local businesses, for local restaurants. You know, we've created 7 Days. We've created directories for food, for to-go, directories for local retailers right now. We're encouraging everyone to buy local, and absolutely it should extend to your local media. And, you know, Vermont is a leader in socially responsible businesses. We have this great Vermont Social Businesses, Businesses for Social Responsibility. We have B Corps in the state. I think that buying local in terms of advertising should definitely be a part of that. You know, scrutinizing your advertising spending, I think, should definitely be a part of looking at how socially responsible you are. Buying local is, I mean, it literally right now, when you invest and buy local for your media, not just 7 Days or all these other entities that you're mentioning, but actual local community newspapers all across Vermont who are threatened in the pandemic because their local advertising base has shrunk. When you advertise with those folks, you are supporting your community. You know, a community without coverage does not remain one for long. You know, we need these entities, and I think it is absolutely part of our part of our message, anyway, that buying local when it comes to advertising local media is really crucial.
Yeah, and when that doesn't happen, to me this is almost analogous. I mean, tell me if you agree, Kathy. To, I don't know, a giant fast food chain coming into town and basically outcompeting and forcing the closure of, you know, some local restaurants.
Right. Yes. And the thing is that people haven't seen, they haven't seen Facebook this way. People don't see Facebook this way. And that's partly why we have been writing these publisher notes. You know, we've been, since the pandemic started, we've been, at 7 Days, we've been writing publisher notes to talk about our business, because it has been such an incredible time, and we've had to lean on readers for support for the first time in our history. And we've been a lot more transparent about our business and talking about our business as a business, not just the media that we cover. But I think we need to really emphasize that more, because we're going to lose these very important pillars of our democracy if we don't.
All right. Well, Kathy Reisman's been my guest this whole first hour. I really appreciate you joining me this morning, Kathy. She's deputy publisher at 7 Days. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
All righty. Going to a top of the hour break for some CBS News. A couple words from our sponsors. We'll be talking with CBS News political consultant Leonard Steinhorn just after that. And then opening the phone lines for a bit. And more of the Dave Graham Show coming. Stay with us.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Heading into the second hour of our Wednesday morning program here, July the 1st, 2020. Thanks very much for staying with us. And I believe we have one of our CBS News correspondents on the line with us this morning, Leonard Steinhorn. Good morning, Leonard.
Hey, good morning to you.
How are you doing?
You know, we're all trying to make it day by day.
Yeah, we made it halfway through the year. That's pretty good, right? So
yeah, no kidding, you know. But yeah. Unfortunately, lots of Americans didn't, and this coronavirus thing continues to spike, and this is what's, I think, top of mind for so many people these days.
Yeah, that is really a striking situation where this attempt to reopen, which, you know, I think was sort of happening independent of what was really happening in many instances was happening independent of what was happening with the pandemic. Just hasn't worked out. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know that shutting down the whole economy is the long term answer either, because obviously that creates a whole lot of problems in and of itself. But you're the political consultant that, with CBS News. We get on the radio here occasionally, and which I really appreciate, by the way. And so I'm going to ask you, with this sort of turn or increase in intensity nationwide in the coronavirus pandemic, what do you see as its political fallout in this election year?
Well, you know, I think there's a degree of horror that, yes, people wanted to reopen. Yes, we want businesses to survive. Yes, mm-hmm. we want to resume as much of daily life as we can. But the overreaction of some, where they go to bars and shout and scream or want to go to a live concert and not wear masks, you know, we could reopen with a middle ground, with people observing social distancing, wearing a mask, going about their business, gradually doing this, and that would have been a far more sensible way of doing it. Yet, for some reason, wearing a mask or, you know, social distancing becomes a political issue. And I think that's sort of emblematic of where we are in the country right now. And to a lot of people, think about older folks who are most worried about getting this virus. Think about a lot of people who are in the middle politically, moderates, independents. The whole idea that we sort of went gung-ho into full normal life again without any sort of sense that, you know, that not wearing a mask could potentially infect other people or infect members of your family who are more at risk or vulnerable. I think that's sort of this sort of paradigm shift among a lot of voters, which is, oh, my gosh, we have to pull back. We have to gain a sense of sanity on all of this. And I think that sort of reaction that people are having is what is really diminishing the president's approval ratings, because they associate him with a sort of gung-ho denial that we can go and resume normal life without any consequences and to sort of never wear a mask and to be disdainful of that. So I think had the president early on become sort of that voice of moderation in the middle, we got to resume life, but we got to do it sensibly. Please observe wearing the mask. I will in public settings when I have people closer than 6 feet. And had he done that, I think his approval ratings would be up. I think people would be saying, yes, he sort of tried to strike a balance on all of this, and they would respect him more for that type of leadership. But when his approval ratings and favorability ratings are now in the high 30s, I think it reflects sort of an alienation from either the lack of leadership he's shown or for the wrong-headed leadership that many people believe that he's put forth during this crisis.
One of the things that I don't know, I sometimes, if I were in the ad writing game, I would probably write one featuring a police officer, a firefighter, and a member of the military, and I would have them sort of dressing in the, getting all their gear on at the beginning of their workday, and have them say, in the name of protecting other people, you know, I put on a bulletproof vest when it's 95 degrees outside. I put on all this firefighter gear, including the big jacket and the air tank and, you know, the helmet and everything. I put on the military gear, and I do all this in the name of protecting other Americans. Hey, folks, if you honor us when we're killed in the line of duty, what about honoring us right now by doing this simple little thing of putting on this other piece of gear called a face mask?
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. And you have to do it in a way that sort of respects the sort of individualism in America, this anti-authority sentiment that sort of threaded through our culture. Lots of Americans, they just don't want to be told what to do. And you tell them what to do, they will push back and do almost the opposite. That's sort of part of our cultural DNA for a lot of Americans. I mean, yeah. Still see how many American men especially refuse to wear a seatbelt, thinking that there's something wrong with it. They don't want to be told what to do. They can defy the odds.
Seatbelts are for snowflakes, right?
Right, exactly. So, I mean, I think one has to be able to communicate in a way that, as you're suggesting, or as other people are suggesting, which is maybe to turn the defiance not against those people recommending that we wear masks, but defiance against the virus. Defiance against spreading this thing. That a show of strength is in solidarity, that we're going to make sure that grandma and grandpa, or that the healthcare worker or the police officer doesn't get sick because of our own recklessness. And we want to defy the odds. So somehow we have to be able to communicate it to larger numbers of people. But I do think that the most effective person in that is the President of the United States. I mean, that the President has the bully pulpit. And particularly in this case, because not wearing a mask is seen as something that's Republican, that's unfortunate. And I think the president can correct it. You see a lot of Republican senators now. You even see Vice President Pence recommending that people wear masks and being a little bit more aggressive on that. If the president went out and did it, and he sort of said, okay, we've got to be able to do this. Let's strike a middle ground. We want to keep ourselves open, but we do the social distancing. We respect the CDC guidelines. We do that. We do it aggressively. We can open and rebuild. All of a sudden, I think his favorability might begin to tick up, as long as he hasn't completely alienated people who have been driving down his numbers already.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, what about this other this other story that is broken this week or late last week about the bounties being paid on the deaths of American soldiers in Afghanistan, allegedly by Russia, and the president first saying he'd never been told about it. Now reporting is pretty solid that he did get a presidential daily brief. Is this going to have a rippling effect into the? I mean, it seems like, you know, Republicans historically have been the party of a strong military and of not being pushed around by other countries and so on and so forth. Something different here. What about that? Is that, does that have any political legs to speak of?
Yeah, I think it does in a lot of ways. And there are a number of sort of angles and dimensions to it. First, if he was unaware of this and he did not know about it, and yet it was in his daily briefing, that says something. I mean, if he's asleep at the wheel, that's not what we want a president to do. But let's say he did know about it and ignored it for whatever reasons. And some obviously speculate about his relationship with Putin and all of that, you know, involved there. That's concerning as well. But then you look at it in a more sort of granular political way, and you think about service members and veterans and how they're interpreting this. I mean, you know, the president, you know, continues to have support among many folks in the military, but he's tested that support over the years. First, for example, when he criticized John McCain a bunch of years ago for being captured in combat, Recently, a lot of folks were very nervous about how he wanted to deploy the military against American protesters in the streets of American cities, and that concerned people. That's sort of not what you use the military for, against American citizens. But in this particular case, if you didn't either pay attention or if you ignored the fact that Russia, from all reports, seemed to have been providing bounties to the Taliban to kill American troops, that's sort of a violation of a sacred trust that many folks in the service will feel toward the commander-in-chief. And you have to imagine that the conversations that are going on among veterans, among people who are currently serving, there has to be some questions being raised about that. My hunch is that even if they were predisposed to support the president, among many of them, some might be taking a second look at Joe Biden, because, you know, at what point does certain behavior cross the line? So, again, I do think this can have consequences.
All right. Well, Leonard Steinhorn, I really appreciate you joining me again this morning on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. It's good talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
Yes, let's do it. Thanks. Take care.
All right. Hey, we do have a caller on the line. I believe it's David from Burlington. Good morning, David.
Happy Canada Day to you.
And to you as well.
Have you been following Heather Cox Richardson?
Mm-hmm.
I just want to take a moment to recommend her daily blog post to people who aren't familiar with it. I just think she does an incredible job of looking at the news every day, and about 4:30 in the morning emails this post out. You can subscribe for free, which summarizes the events of the prior day in a way that just makes all the nuance and detail come to life. I'm just incredibly impressed with her. The more I read her, for the last few days, she's just been doing an incredible job on the Russia bounty story and all kinds of other stuff. I just think she's terrific. She's a historian who teaches at a college near Boston, and I hope this daily blog of hers gets her tenure or a book deal or whatever. Heather Cox Richardson.
Heather Cox Richardson. I have read some of her stuff from time to time, but I don't subscribe and have not made a daily habit of it, but I see people linking to it occasionally on Facebook or Twitter, and I follow the link and go and read it. And I do agree that from what I've read, she is a very, very lucid and intelligent writer, and someone who, I'll tell you, David, though, it's tough because there's just so much stuff out there competing for our time. I mean, how do you ever come up with a priority list? You know, go ahead.
You make a great point, Dave, and that's why I value what she does so much, because if I had only one thing to read every day and I read her short piece, I think I'd be better informed than I read newspapers every day. It's a passion of mine. But sometimes, as you say, your eyes just kind of cross, and it's hard to keep up with it. But she started one of her pieces just the other day by saying, things are happening so fast it's hard to keep up. Here's what's happening. And then she set forth the stories of the day so succinctly, but brought in the details, tied the threads. Anyway, you get the idea. I'm just blathering now. Yep. But anybody who's not familiar with her, she sends out a daily blog, and you can subscribe for free or just take one look at it, and it's easy to share with your friends, and I just think she stops, as are you, Dave.
Well, thanks, David, but Heather Cox Richardson is a play. I gather if you just Google her, you'll find her, and you will be able to subscribe if you like, and go from there, right?
Yeah, for people like me who consider your 5 past 10 interviews with journalists appointment radio, as I do, I think those folks would really appreciate what Heather Cox Richardson does.
All right. Well, thanks very much again. It's good talking with you, David. Let's go to
Happy Canada Day.
Oh, yeah, you too. Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Dave. Hey, two issues to cover today. One you mentioned before the break, and unfortunately, surprisingly enough, it isn't really the most important thought I had in my mind today, but I do want to bring it up because it wasn't so much the comment I read in Facebook that got to me. I mean, everybody's entitled, and I'm entitled to my opinion as how I feel about it, but it's more about what I would deem a little bit of hypocrisy in that the persona you portray on the radio, rightfully going after Donald Trump for all the nicknames and comments he makes about people, which is despicable, especially for his office, but then to turn around and make a disparaging comment about people, you know, who don't wear masks. It rubbed me the wrong way, to be perfectly honest with you. And that goes for anybody. It's not a political issue. It's just I'm very much one who believes that, you know, live what you speak. That's all. So that's why I brought that up yesterday.
Okay, I will confess that I do occasionally get annoyed, and I usually save that for Facebook. I mean, I sort of feel like I try to be more mellow and kind of middle of the road here on the radio, believe it or not.
No, I understand it.
And I just really feel like anybody who thinks it's a political statement not to wear a mask, I don't know what the right analogy would be, but essentially you're going out in public and you're contributing to a significant amount of risk, not for yourself, but for other people. Okay.
Right.
So there's an element of selfishness here that is just really unfortunate, I think, and it's frankly unethical. And that's why I went there. And I thought it was kind of funny because it involves the word hats. You know, so
right.
A mask doesn't. You know, I'm not going to say exactly what it was on the radio either.
Fine.
But you know, so I was attempting to be a little bit funny, and the other part of it was I really think that this idea that we're going to make a political statement by not wearing masks or express our support for a particular politician who doesn't wear masks or whatever his reasons are, is just, again, this is not a political issue, folks. This is a health issue. Okay, so it's sort of like if you were if you had 20/20 vision with your glasses on and you were required to drive with glasses because without your glasses you had 20/80 vision, and you say, well, I'm a tough individualistic American and I can do what I want, and you go out and drive around without glasses on, you hit somebody. Yeah, I'm not buying it. Yes. Okay, I'm just not buying it.
No, and I don't know all the reasons why people don't wear masks. I think for the most part, people are doing it, and I think it's childish. But I think some people have some legitimate issues for whatever reason. And
I've read medical. You know, people have medical reasons for you know, their breathing difficulties or something. Okay, that I excuse, and I don't have any problem with that. But when somebody says I'm not going to wear a mask just because, you know, I want to express my support for Donald Trump or something, I'm saying, let's leave the politics out of this discussion about our health, okay? Just, we don't have to, it's not a style question, really, so much as it is, I mean, I made a joke about it being a style question, but it is really not a style question so much as it is, I don't like wearing a mask either, especially when it's hot out, you know, it's kind of uncomfortable, and it's, you know, et cetera. So I'll go in the store, I have my mask on, I come out, I get in my own car with the windows on, rolled in the air conditioner on, and I'll take the mask off because you know, it just feels better without it. So that's, I understand that completely. The difficulty I have is with people who are trying to make this quote unquote statement, and it's just
understood.
I think it's kind of, yeah.
Hey, let me very right? quickly get to the next issue. That was
point number two.
The comments about the Facebook and things being posted that, you know, have no basis in fact. Well, it brings me to one that really bothered me for many years, and it's this. Do you remember when Gabby Giffords got shot? Do you remember what the conversation was for about a week or two afterwards? Every radio station, every newscast, especially those that leaned left, talked about rhetoric. That's all we heard for day in, day out, because it was assumed, wrongfully eventually, that this was a result of some right-wing nut who listened to Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levin, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then went out and used that anger that was, you know, pushed by those people in order to shoot. Right? Until we found out it was a dropout, pot-smoking person living in the basement of his parents' house. Hardly the example of what would be kind of conservative. But the minute that news came out, the term rhetoric just died away. And all of a sudden, there was no talk about it, and I never saw one news outlet come on and say, you know what, we were wrong. Not one news media source, including some conservatives, or Mark Johnson himself, who actually talked about it on the radio, came out and said, listen, you know what? We assumed something we should not have assumed. We put out a narrative that was inaccurate, and we apologize for that. And I would expect that. I don't expect it from everyday people, because I don't think everyday people have enough recognition of their own guilt when they do things like that. But the media, I would hold it to a little higher level, and I'd expect them to have done that. And I never heard an apology from any news outlet, period.
Yeah, I don't have enough of the facts or the really sense of the history that much to relitigate all of this right now, Paul. But I would say that that is a fairly common human tendency that does show up in the media occasionally. It's not our best, that clearly wasn't a shining moment for the news media. If what you say is actually what unfolded there, and I sort of have a hunch that it was. I have no reason to disbelieve you. And so I would say on that one that it is important for the media to go back and revisit, especially, you know, really huge narratives. I mean, I remember the New York Times famously did just somersaults of mea culpa after the stories they ran in the early 2000s about how, you know, Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and there was bad sourcing on that story, but it really pushed the agenda of those who wanted to go to war in Iraq.
Right.
But the New York Times later, to its credit, came out and did extensive reporting on its own mistakes there. The journalist who led the coverage left the paper. There are some opportunities or some instances there of the media doing pretty good self-correction. This one sounds like it may have been missed, and I'm not here to make excuses for it at all. No. Or anything like that.
And once again, that's not politically aimed, because there were news articles. Yep. On both sides of the political aisle on both issues.
Yep.
Where they got it wrong, and most people, regardless, did not actually apologize. And that, you know, that always bothers me. And I think that people do apologize will find themselves looked at in a little different light than those who don't, because the mea culpa, you know, admits that you're human, you make mistakes, and people are more willing to cut slack. All right, thanks, Dave.
All right, thank you for the call, Paul. Hey, we are going to go to a bottom of the hour break here for some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors. And when we return, we're going to be talking with a leader of the National Committee to Protect Social Security and Medicare. Find out what's going on at Capitol Hill related to those big programs. We'll be back shortly, folks. Stay with us.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, and we wanted to take the last 25 minutes, half hour, or whatever, of this program today to talk to our friend Max Richmond. He is with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. These are big, important programs. I know to many WDEV listeners and even some who are looking forward to years ahead, perhaps making use of these federal programs, Social Security and Medicare, obviously very, very crucial to many of our elderly residents, in particular, and some younger residents as well. Occasionally there are new developments popping up on Capitol Hill relating to these programs, and we like to check in with Max Richmond to get caught up on what's been happening. And I believe he's on the phone with us this morning. Thank you very much for joining me, Max.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Glad to do it. So what's your top headline in this realm this week as we begin the month of July in the second half of 2020?
Well, it's really astounding to many of us that after so many attempts to eliminate the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that failed. You remember there were, I think, more than 50 votes in the House, and the famous vote in the Senate where John McCain turned the thumbs down on repealing the Affordable Care Act. But that has not stopped this administration's ongoing assault against the Affordable Care Act. The administration has now joined in a lawsuit asking the Supreme Court to overturn the law. This makes no sense, particularly during this pandemic, and I think makes it clear that the president's promise not to touch Medicare or Social Security during the 2016 campaign was really an empty promise.
Well, explain to me a little bit about, I heard a shift there from the Affordable Care Act on the one hand to Medicare and Social Security. Could you logically have a president who said, I'm going to get rid of the Affordable Care Act because I don't like it? You know, it has my predecessor's name on it, and that's the worst sin any legislation could ever have. Versus, on the other hand, the president saying, but while I'm going to get rid of ACA or Obamacare, I'm going to preserve these other two longer standing programs that Barack Obama didn't create, and therefore they're okay.
Well, there's an inconsistency inherent in that observation. The Affordable Care Act improved the Medicare program in a number of pretty dramatic ways. Repealing the Affordable Care Act eliminates those improvements to the Medicare program. Number one, the Affordable Care Act extended the solvency of the Medicare program to 2028. Now, that may be moved up now because of massive unemployment that has reduced the funding that goes into the Part A, the Medicare program, the hospital part. The Affordable Care Act eliminated the donut hole in the prescription drug part of the Medicare program that saved seniors $27 billion in the last 10 years. That improvement is eliminated. Very importantly, under the Affordable Care Act, Medicare beneficiaries can receive a number of treatments with no out-of-pocket costs, no cost sharing for many chronic disease screenings for cancer, diabetes, heart disease, colonoscopy, mammograms, with no cost sharing. Millions of seniors have also taken advantage of an annual wellness visit under the Affordable Care Act that is added to the Medicare program. Lastly, the Affordable Care Act reduces the rate of increases in premiums and overpayments by the government to the Medicare Advantage plans. I don't know how many people in Vermont sign up for Medicare Advantage. Those changes, those improvements in the Affordable Care Act to the Medicare program all disappear if this lawsuit is successful.
Okay, so there is a significant amount of overlap here where if you take away the ACA, you actually do take away numerous recent, or at the time of the ACA, that is, you know, last 10-year recent improvements to Medicare in and of itself. Now I understand the connection. That's good.
Absolutely correct.
Okay. The Supreme Court had a shot at the Affordable Care Act a couple of years ago, and basically did not take it away effectively. I am wondering what's the new basis legally for going back to the court. Normally, the court doesn't like to get the same case back within a few years.
These are now lawsuits that have been filed by a number of states. I don't have the list in front of me, trying to have the Affordable Care Act repealed. And the issues have vary among states. But you're absolutely right. The court took this up, part of this, the Affordable Care Act, a number of years ago. And really, Justice Roberts, who seems to have become the decisive vote in the Supreme Court, preserved the program at that time. But you know what is so baffling is why now, when people need more health care, it's more important than ever. There would be yet another effort to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. I don't understand it. I think a lot of people fail to understand that what the incentive is for the federal government now to make another run at eliminating the Affordable Care Act.
I know this president has wanted to eliminate the Affordable Care Act since he was campaigning in 2016. And you know, that was a key campaign promise of his, really. Maybe it's just a matter of, you know, he's coming up on his 4-year mark here. He does want another term. He wants to be able to go into the fall campaign saying, I keep my campaign promises. Therefore, let's take another shot at this. But I want to ask you, do you have any sense of sort of what would be left standing or what would replace the Affordable Care Act? Is there anything that the president is proposing aside from getting rid of the Affordable Care Act, either repealing it or striking it down in the court? Is there anything there to kind of fill in as a substitute?
Well, that's what's so remarkable about this latest effort is there is nothing out that's been proposed to replace. Remember, there was a lot of talk for a few years about repeal and replace. There's mm-hmm. no replacement right now. It's a position that seems to have overlooked the whatever the administration likes in the Affordable Care Act is to be extended or recreated, because there's nothing there right now. So it's a vacuum. And you mentioned on Social Security. I thought I should highlight one of your opening comments that is so important for people to understand. Social Security, as you stated so accurately, is a program. Yes, it's important to seniors, to those who have reached 67, which will be the age for eligibility, unless someone claims benefits at 62. 67 will be the age for everybody very soon. It's not just for seniors. A third of Social Security benefits go to non-retired workers, spouses, survivors, as you, I'm sure, know, children, disabled. This is a program that every family has a stake in protecting. And another promise, yes, the president promised during the campaign in 2016 to eliminate the Affordable Care Act. He also promised to protect the Social Security program. I remember all those primary debates in 2016, and candidate Trump was the only one of 17 highly qualified candidates running for the Republican nomination that said time and again, I won't touch Social Security. So what has he done mm-hmm. in the last few years? Tried to eliminate the payroll tax, defer it, reduce it. That is doing a lot more than touching Social Security. That's strangling the program. The only source of revenue for Social Security is the payroll tax, the FICA tax. And
right.
if that is eliminated or reduced, that is a way to strangle the program by cutting its financing.
Are you worried that with all the massive spending by the federal government on the coronavirus response in the last 4 or 5 months, that people are going to look at Social Security as a secondary priority versus either more funding for the coronavirus as it now continues, or paying back some of the debt that's been generated by this massive federal bailout of all these businesses and all these individuals out there?
Absolutely, I'm worried about it. And we have been here before. Remember, a couple of years ago, we had an enormous tax cut that was pushed through by this administration, most of the benefits going to corporate America and wealthier individuals. All those Republicans for years who screamed about the federal debt and the annual deficit and how it was growing, they were mute during that debate until it passed. And then all of a sudden, we started hearing from leading Republicans in Congress, including the majority leader, Senator McConnell, Senator Rubio. All of a sudden, they came to the realization that we've now added all this money to the federal debt, and we've got to do something. And what do we have to do? Look at Social Security. Look at Medicare. So I am worried that we're going to see the same pattern here. where we have, again, added enormous amount to the federal debt through the efforts to deal with the pandemic. And we're starting to hear that already. Well, we've got to look at cutting entitlements. First of all, Social Security is not an entitlement. It's an earned benefit. You pay for it while you're working. Same with Medicare Part A, the hospital part of Medicare. You pay through the payroll tax to support those programs. So we're seeing, I think, a pattern here, just as you pointed out, where these programs will be targeted because of the need to cut the federal deficit.
Yeah, I think that's like, you know, what Willie Sutton said about robbing banks. It's because that's where the money is, right?
Exactly.
And
that's where the money
I shouldn't
is.
Laugh, but I mean, that's really, there's not much else out there that that looks as tempting to be cut, I'm sure, to at least to some people. You know, obviously, you know, liberals and progressives talk about the military budget, but that has been pretty impervious to efforts to make, you know, serious inroads over time. And so, you know, the other big pot of federal spending right now that could conceivably be used, diverted or whatever, are these two programs that your committee is dedicated to preserving. Max Richmond of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, I wonder if you are if you have a sense of these programs and their defense really being political issues in this upcoming campaign. And I mean, will the president be back out there on the stump saying, "I'm not going to touch Social Security and Medicare"? Will he be, you know, trying to make that claim? Will folks be looking to the Democrat Joe Biden as somebody who's better equipped to protect these things? What is your sense of how this will play politically?
It's difficult to comprehend how the president could be campaigning on not touching Social Security again this time around when he didn't keep that promise the last time. In many of the president's budgets, there have been cuts to the Social Security Disability Program, efforts to make it much more difficult and onerous to qualify for Social Security Disability. The Social Security budget that was sent up to the Congress to run the program, when most of that money comes out of the payroll tax as well, efforts have been made to cut it. Congress rejected most of those and put the money back in. And this latest effort to reduce the payroll tax is an end run. It's a way to eviscerate the program and talk about how these cuts to the payroll tax are necessary so workers can hold on to more of their money. Now, I followed the last 2012 campaign, and I remember Vice President Biden campaigning all over the country, being very vocal about protecting the Social Security program, not reducing it. And I know that he's committed during this campaign to doing just that. I'm told that just yesterday, Vice President Biden called for adding $200 a month to the checks of everyone who collects Social Security and increasing Medicaid spending by 12%. I'm not totally sure that's accurate, but I've been hearing about it this morning. This is the addition of $200 a month for Social Security benefits during this pandemic is an idea that was floated during the primary season by Senator Elizabeth Warren. So I'm very curious to see if there'll be more discussion about that.
Yeah, does that sound like it would be in the realm of feasibility right now?
Well, I think so. I think that it would be very beneficial to seniors on Social Security who have fallen behind on their benefits as compared to what inflation is doing to those benefits. You know, one of the beauties of the Social Security program, it has a built-in cost of living adjustment. So supposedly your Social Security benefit keeps up with the cost of with the increased inflation, so you don't fall behind because
yep.
inflation is taking more of the Social Security check. Unfortunately, the formula to determine that cost of living adjustment is flawed. Seniors have fallen behind. There were a number of years in the last 10 where the COLA was zero because the formula mm-hmm. for determining it is flawed, and there are proposals in the Congress, namely by Congressman John Larson, a neighbor of yours from Connecticut, who has legislation that would improve the program, do a number of things, and also correct the calculation for the COLA. So a benefit for a number of months, adding $200 to the Social Security check, would make up for that loss because the COLA formula has not adequately kept seniors on Social Security up with inflation.
So this is a case. This is a case where COLA would be better than Diet COLA.
Yes, you know, we talked about COLA wars years ago.
Uh-huh.
this is so important to Social Security beneficiaries. I have done hundreds of town hall meetings around the country, mostly with members of Congress. And the one thing that is absolutely clear that the seniors on Social Security anxiously wait for the announcement every fall of what the COLA would be.
And mm-hmm.
because they're trying to plan how they can get by. You know, the average benefit in Vermont is $1,419 a month. That's it, the average.
Yeah.
On Social Security benefits. It's not, it's as easy to see how that is, it's how that that amount of money is really not adequate to meet the basic needs of seniors. So an additional amount and a COLA that is accurately reflects inflation as it impacts the seniors, those are two things that really I think would be vital improvements to the program.
Are you worried now, though? I mean, I just, when I look at the federal spending that has happened in response to the coronavirus, you know, the pandemic, I sort of think to myself, when we get, assuming the pandemic, you know, eventually comes to a close or gets under control or there's a vaccine or some kind of a resolution to this story, basically. Nobody really knows anything, but let's try to crystal ball it 10 years ahead. It's 2030, and the federal government, as we look back on it, will have taken on how much? Do you know off the top how much debt? I've lost track. I know it's in the trillions.
Yeah, it's easy to lose track because we're talking about trillions, which is hard to comprehend. But
yeah, yeah,
it's several trillion dollars has been added to the federal debt in the last 6 months.
Yeah, you know, and eventually, we assume that Americans are going to have to pay this off, basically. And so imagine we're 10 years out and this is, and you know, the bills are coming due. How will that phenomenon affect a program like Social Security or Medicare?
Well, just as we were talking about, it puts more pressure, on these programs by those who believe that, as you said, and that these programs are where the money is. The important thing when that concept is raised is to understand, yes, these programs have money. Social Security has a reserve in a trust fund of $2.9 trillion created by design to accommodate those who have started entering the program in the last few years. And that money was paid for by the payroll tax. There is no Social Security doesn't have a deficit. it has a surplus, and it only receives funding from the payroll tax. So this is a unique program in that it has a dedicated revenue stream, does not rely on federal resources beyond that dedicated revenue stream. And I believe, and I think a lot of people that support Social Security, and it has overwhelming political support among Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, that needs to be walled off because it did not add a penny. Social Security has not added a penny to that burgeoning federal debt, and it shouldn't be used as a piggy bank to address that federal debt. It did not create it. It is independent of it, and it shouldn't be relied on to help the federal government dig out of this hole that is being gotten much deeper in terms of federal deficit over the last few years.
Very, very difficult right now, though, because, I mean, you think about all something like 40 million Americans have been out of work. People's capacity to pay taxes is way reduced. And you know, let's assume that economic shockwaves last for a year or two. It's not going to be easy to get busy paying back these massive piles of debt anytime soon, right?
That's right. And that's also why it's so important to keep our keep focused on the importance of the Social Security program. Maybe more so now than at most times. Many of those people who have lost their jobs, who perhaps were going to wait until 67 to start collecting Social Security, find themselves forced to begin at 62. This program has rarely been as vital as it is right now. And one thing that I think is important to keep in mind when there's talk about cutting the payroll tax, the fact that we have such high unemployment, I think it's, like you said, over 45 million people unemployed, they're not paying payroll tax.
Yeah, they're not paying, so it's already been...
They don't have a paycheck. So
the revenues have already been cut.
The resources in the trust fund, the projections... when that trust fund would be unable to completely accommodate all beneficiaries, that's going to be moved up closer to the present because there's less money going in. We don't need to now talk about...
Max, I got to do this. I hate to say, but I'm going to interrupt you and tell you we're about out of time, unfortunately. And we got to go to the top of the hour news and the end of the Dave Graham Show for this Wednesday morning, July the 1st. Thank you very much for listening, folks. Stay tuned now for the governor's news conference on the Corona 19 response. Max Richmond, thank you very much. Talk to you all tomorrow, folks.